Mark Brewer as former chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. Jeff Timmer as former executive director of the Michigan Republicans. And this is a republic, if you can keep it, with Mark Brewer and Jeff Timmer.
I'm Jeff Timmer, and this is A Republic If You Can Keep It. In a few minutes, Mark Brewer and I will be joined by Walt Sorg, who is one of the founders of Voters Not Politicians, the group that was responsible for the constitutional amendment in Michigan that gave us the Citizen Redistricting Commission. But we begin, as always, with the politics of the week. And Mark, let's begin with the nationwide and worldwide tragedy that's on everybody's minds, the shooting at the Oxford High School. And let's make sure that we're not talking about the tragedy itself so much as the politics that surround this issue and will fuel some of the political rhetoric and action here in the aftermath.
Yeah, that's right, Jeff. And I think we want to be very clear here with our listeners. This was a horrible incident, but we're not here to talk about that piece. I mean, we're focused on the politics of what now happens. Yeah, Jeff, I think this is going to go a lot of different directions. You know, I've seen already people starting to investigate the background of the parents. And the prosecutor has indicated that she's looking very seriously at charging the parents. In terms of access to the gun, access to ammunition, et cetera, et cetera. The media has already begun to dig into the parents' background. And I see that there are some Trump connections that have already been discovered. So this could very quickly, I think, get politicized. Maybe we're going to see something like what happened with the Kenosha vigilante, where, you know, the parents are somehow turned into right-wing martyrs in support of the Second Amendment. So there's that direction that this could go. This puts school boards in a real difficult spot. I see today that there were dozens and dozens and dozens of school closings in Oakland County because of threats. And of course, in Oakland County, this doesn't just involve Democrats. You know, Sheriff Bouchard is a Republican. We have a Democratic prosecutor in Oakland County. So the politics of this, I think, could get very complex locally in terms of how this plays out through the investigation. There's going to be a prosecution of this young man, apparently as an adult. That could be a source of controversy as well. Just lots of things here, I think, that could spin out from this. But you and I have both seen in shootings like this and otherwise around the country, as in Kenosha, how quickly this can become politicized.
We've seen, I think, a fairly unified public front from the prosecutor, who's a Democrat, and the sheriff, who's a Republican. I have talked to some sources who are in the know, and they've expressed, the history that there's certainly no love lost between those two. And there's behind the scenes quite a kabuki dance going on for who's going to be getting the primacy and the most limelight. But so far, at least public facing, that has stayed behind the scenes. But that's the kind of thing that's the kind of political thing that does go on in an issue like this. People somewhat take off their partisan hats at times, but the partisan hats are always at play here. You know, one of the things that I tweeted about this yesterday in the aftermath is that if history is any indication, what we're going to do is have conversations like this for a few days and then forget about it and move on. We've shown for more than 20 years since Columbine and so many copycat shootings like this over more than two decades that we're not going to, we as the collective, the collective political, our elected officials, whether they're in state capitals or in Washington, they'll talk about it. They won't do anything about it. We as a people, as our culture, will lament when these things happen because they're horrific. But we won't demand that they actually take steps, have a real serious debate about what can be done, what might be done, and what we have the will to do to stop it from happening again. Instead, we treat these things like storms, like hurricanes that hit, they cause a bunch of devastation, we clean up and we move on, and then it happened again, and we don't do anything about it because we haven't demanded that something be done, whether it was Columbine, whether it was Sandy Hook, whether it was Parkhurst, or whether it's now Oxford High School. If history is our indication, we're not going to do anything. We're going to be the only country in the world where this happens with this frequency on this scale. And it's a shame that we're just going to tolerate this. But that's right. What I think we'll do.
I think that's right, Jeff, on a national scale now. But I think it's going to be hard to ignore this in Michigan. And this young man, the shooter, is going to go on trial in Oakland County during an election year. And it's hard to imagine that this won't become an issue. I look at what happened in other states as well, not just for people running for legislature and local government, but also we have elected judges in this state. And as we've all learned, these kind of cases focus a lot of attention on the judges, who then have to stand for election and so forth. So I think there's a lot of ways in which this could become very politically charged or politically fraught and could have a lot of implications for next year's elections. You know, I mentioned school boards, right? We just went through and we've seen in the state, you've talked about this, how contentious school boards have become, you know, with all the fighting over critical race theory, masking, you know, what are your pandemic policies? This now could also become a political football at schools in terms of what school boards are willing to do, what the local population will allow them to do in terms of safeguards at the schools.
I don't want to let an opportunity go by to say something bad about Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky, and so I'm not going to. In yesterday, when asked by reporters, you know, what is he willing to do as leader of the Michigan Senate, and he indicated effectively that he was willing to do nothing, that the change that would be required is not something that he's willing to do. He wouldn't like the country that would turn us into. I think most people in the aftermath of this would disagree with Mike Shirky and would be glad to turn into a country that didn't tolerate the mass murder of their children.
Right. And, you know, that's a straw man that he set up. It's not all or nothing, right? There are things you can do. You can increase security presence in the schools. You know, there are things you can do short of what a lot of folks consider draconian gun control measures that, you know, they're never going to agree to. But there are other measures that can be taken short of that that should be politically palatable to folks. And again, should be done just because of the horrific nature of this. So, you know, we should be able to send our children to school and not worry about whether they're going to come back alive that day. You would hope that this is something that people could come together politically on. But as you and I have both seen far too often, that's usually not the case.
Let's also talk about the news out of Washington this week, where they heard the oral arguments regarding the Mississippi abortion case that many assume, well, they will be considering whether or not to erode Roe versus Wade or overturn Roe versus Wade. There's certainly a lot of supercharged emotion around the issue, and there's certainly a lot of supercharged politics. Let me start by just putting my two cents in that as a longtime Republican and someone who has been active over the years with the pro-life movement in Michigan, from a political electoral standpoint, I see abortion as an issue where, from a Republican perspective, it's kind of like if the dog actually catches the car. It's something that's looming out there to motivate voters. But if Roe is actually overturned, I don't think the Republicans are going to like the political result and the passion that I think it will unleash, not just among Democrats, but among many on the center right, many in the pro-life movement who might be very anti-abortion, but are also anti-criminalizing their wives and their daughters and their doctors.
I think that's right, Jeff. I think that, you know, the politics of this could be remarkable. I'll just say that. If Roe gets overturned or significantly limited, Michigan has a criminal abortion statute on the laws. It doesn't criminalize the woman, but it does criminalize providers like doctors and others. That's been there since 1931. It's been basically, for the most part, unenforceable since Roe, but that arguably comes back into effect if Roe is overturned. And what does that do? You know, we're going to make criminals out of doctors who are providing the service to women. But then you're right, the dog who caught the car. What does the dog do next? And again, I'm not trying to demean anybody. I'm just playing off your metaphor. Are there efforts then by so-called pro-life forces in the state to get the legislature to adopt further legislation, which the governor would veto? Do they do a petition drive or drives to enact laws that supplement the 31 law? And I can't imagine that pro-choice forces are just going to sit there and let all this happen either. You know, are we going to see litigation saying that that 31 statute is illegal on other ground? Are we going to see pro-choice folks try to get legislation done or do their own petition drive or drives in terms of the future here? You know, I know the governor's already been out front on this issue several weeks ago, demanding the legislature repeal that 31 statute. The attorney general's been very outspoken. And I want to give a shout out to her. She's usually quick with the quip, but I think a quip I saw in the last 24 hours ties these two issues we've been talking about together very well. She said, look, by the end of this Supreme Court term, it could be easier for a teenage boy to get a gun than it could be for an adult woman to get an abortion. And I thought that was a very apt way to try to tie these two issues that you and I have been talking about together. I think abortion could become a huge issue in legislative and statewide elections next year. I mean, the Attorney General, Dan Nestle, has already said, I'm not going to criminally prosecute a woman or a provider. That's certainly where the governor would be on this. I think there are a lot of folks who have a different position. And I'll just end with this, Jeff, and throw it back to you. In my experience, polling on abortion is very tricky. It's very tricky. And a lot of it does come down to, as you know, from your vast experience with polling, how you word the question, right? You can get what seem to be very contradictory responses on what people support based on how you word the question. So I think it's going to be tricky for all the candidates and all the political parties as they try to stake out a position in the wake of Roe being overturned or limited.
I agree with your analysis completely. The only thing I would add is it the way it looks right now, if you take the Supreme Court case and Roe versus Wade out of the equation for 2022, the election is going to be about the job Joe Biden is doing. It's going to be about the economy. It's going to be about COVID. And we saw in Virginia and New Jersey, that is a wind in the face of the Democratic candidates across the country. Now, if with abortion in the mix, that could overnight change the entire dynamic and narrative of the election whenever they come out with a decision. If they decide to throw long and overturn Roe altogether, I think that that will unleash forces in our politics that we have not seen in a long time, including the forces we saw last summer, the summer of 2020, in the Black Lives Matter. I think that the reaction will be that much more widespread, that much more deeply felt, and that much more divisive as we head into the 2022 election.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. They appear to be on a path to, if not outright overturning Roe, certainly cutting it way back. Yeah, remember, and we talked a little bit about this, that in Virginia, McAuliffe tried to inject this issue and Youngkin, you know, pushed it off and was able to fence with it because he clearly didn't want to have to deal with this problem. But that's not going to be possible if Roe gets overturned or limited. You're not going to get away with that. And it's going to create, as I think you've just pointed out, the terrific dilemmas for all Republicans up and down the ballot. They're going to get pushed by their right to life allies, you know, to a real extreme position. Heck, it may even come into play in a Republican primary, right? In terms of who's the most, you know, right to life candidate and who's got the most extreme position, which, as we both know, does not bode well for general elections. If you are pushed into an extreme position, not just on this issue, but on other issues as well.
Jeff and Mark talk redistricting with voters, not politicians, co-founder Walt Sorg after these messages. on a republic if you can keep it.
Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience accurately measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and other federal, state, and local issues. Epic MRA is one of the most quoted polling firms in the country. Clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, local governments, labor unions, interest groups, and businesses throughout Michigan. Whether it's measuring voter opinion about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation can earn voter approval, Epic MRA is known as the go-to Michigan pollster. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Show your support for preserving our republic at the A Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
Joining the discussion this week is one of the people responsible for the petition drive creating the state's Citizen Independent Redistricting Commission, Walt Sorg. Walt has been a part of state policy discussions for more than half a century, beginning as a teenage radio reporter covering the final weeks of the George Romney presidential campaign way back in 1968. Since then, he's held top-level staff positions in all three branches of Michigan government, including 9 years as the press secretary to the Speaker of the House and 3 years as chief spokesman for Governor Jim Blanchard's economic development program.
Walt began working to end partisan gerrymandering in 2013. Ultimately, he became one of the founding board members of Voters Not Politicians, the grassroots group that collected more than 400,000 signatures for the ballot proposal that is now part of the Michigan Constitution. He was one of the primary authors of the amendment, which was approved by 61% of the state's voters. And for full disclosure, he's also the producer of this podcast, usually somebody operating behind the scenes. But this week, we've got him in front of the microphone where I've longed to have him so that we can talk about this proposal and what's going on right now. So normally I'd say welcome to the podcast, but this week I'm going to say to Walt, just unmute your microphone.
Okay. Yeah, we're on Zoom. So can you hear me now?
We can hear you.
Okay. Good to be a part of the pod on this side of it for a week, but I don't want to make a habit of it.
Well, Walt, you're an incredibly valuable resource on this, and I'm just going to dive right in on the latest controversy, which has been going on for a few weeks now, about what are the commission's obligations in terms of doing its business in public. We have this terrible controversy, no matter which side you're on, about the two memos, about which they had a closed meeting a couple of weeks ago. Today, the commission, in a very close vote, at the pleas of their lawyer, pleading with them, they decided not to disclose those memos. We had the publisher of the Detroit News show up at the meeting to say, you need to disclose these memos and tell us what happened behind closed doors, and they refused. I think we're going to end up in court. But Walt, I really got to ask you, what was the intention of the drafters of this proposal when it came to these kinds of things?
Okay, I want to make it clear that I'm speaking for myself. I'm no longer affiliated with Voters Not Politicians, but I was there. I did help write it. And it clearly was the intention of everybody on our founding board. This is not the way it was supposed to go. In our mind, the constitutional requirement that everything be done in the open supersedes anything in state law, including the Open Meetings Act and including the normal provisions of attorney-client privilege. And what they did was just flat out wrong. I think the attorney general's advisory opinion, which really isn't binding on them because it's technically it's a part of the legislative branch, but the advisory opinion was spot on.
Where do you think this is going to go? I mean, I think litigation is clearly going to happen. I think their media groups are lining up to file a lawsuit. I got to tell you, I think I read the Constitution the same way you do. It's very broad. It says open, no exceptions for attorney-client privilege or anything else. And so I think they're in a real conundrum here on the commission. I mean, I got to tell you, as a lawyer, I'm not unsympathetic, right? I wouldn't like my confidential advice to my client to be available to our opponents. So that's a real dilemma for them operating as lawyers. We also learned in the last few days there's not just two documents at issue. There apparently are 10 documents that the lawyers have sent. And again, pleading with them by a letter a couple of days ago and today at the meeting not to release them. But we're about to get into a big fight over this, which for the moment at least is going to overshadow the maps.
I have precisely zero sympathy for the attorneys in this instance. None of this should be news to them. It's not like they're finding out in the fourth quarter as the game's about to end that they didn't have this shield of confidentiality that they would in other circumstances. It's a unique circumstance. It was spelled out in the language of the Constitution that this is different. Those rules don't apply here. And so for them to say, wait, I think, you know, this isn't just an issue that unites both parties, because both parties, people on both sides of the political aisle are opposed to this, but so is everybody else. The only people who are supporting keeping this information secret and shielded from the public are the lawyers who have been giving the information.
And they were able, of the commission.
Well, and a couple members of the commission who they were able to cajole and plead and beg to don't vote this way, because it was going, they were going to release the information until until tears started forming in the lawyers' eyes during the meetings today, going, please don't do this. All the lawyers on the, there are lawyers on the commission, and they all voted to disclose this. They argued in public today that they've already waived the privilege that the lawyers are trying to claim that the commission has now voted to claim that they still have. This just seems like they're prolonging the agony here. It's going to be exposed, all, not just the two memos, but all the other eight that we've suddenly found out about. Everything that they've done, everything that they said, the recording of the closed session, it's all going to come out, and it's all going to come out at a time when they're trying to forge some kind of unity and bipartisan coalition to pass maps that they're required to pass here now at the end of this system. And it's going to break down. It has the potential to break down trust that's already somewhat tenuous between these commissioners, just at the time when they can least afford to have this kind of complication. And it's all a self-created problem.
And also the trust they have in their own lawyers. As you mentioned, it was a close vote. It was a 7-5 vote to do what the lawyers wanted, with all the attorneys voting to do what the lawyers didn't want. And so that creates, I think, a problem for the lawyers moving forward.
Well, and there was an effort today at the meeting by several of the board members to create an oversight committee over the lawyers. So I think that distrust is already there. And you're right, Jeff. This was an unforced error, if it turns out that way. A self-inflicted wound, as it were. But apropos of that, Walt, what other unforced errors or self-inflicted wounds have you seen in the commission process as it's played out so far?
When the commission was first seated, their first job was to hire a staff, and they were of a mindset initially that they wanted to have to be a nonpartisan organization with a nonpartisan staff. So they actively shunned people that had heavy political backgrounds in the state of Michigan, which to my thinking, and I will say I did apply for a position with the commission. They rejected me. I'm glad they did for personal reasons, ultimately. But it dealing with a high visibility political issue, which is what this is a lot different than running a small nonprofit organization or working in an obscure part of the attorney general's office. And these are all good people that they hired, but they're the wrong people.
You know, that's an aspect that I hadn't thought about or looked at is what I've been critical of many of the things that they've done. I've also been complimentary as they kind of, they over time, they started off with just god-awful maps. I mean, ones I said I would have been too embarrassed 10 years ago to release because they were that gerrymandered, and they've moved the needle back, you know, closer to the center. They've still got a long way to go. So many of the problems and bad advice that I think they've been getting along the way probably do stem from some of those initial decisions, they set themselves off on a trajectory that led them down this path. And you know, they're the guinea pigs the first time this is tried. But 10 years from now, none of these people are going to be involved in the process, from the staff to the commissioners. And we're effectively going to be doing this all over again, unless we have a new constitution or an amended constitution.
But we will have the record of what they did right and what they did wrong this time. And they're going to set the tone. We learned when we talked with the commissioners from California, which has a very similar system to Michigan, that they learned a lot in their first cycle, and their second cycle worked out a whole lot better as a result.
Well, let me be more specific here, Walt. I don't want to put you on the spot. We don't want to name names or anything else like that. That's fine. But let me just ask. I mean, they were very clearly, when they started drawing maps, and I think this was the source of the problem that Jeff just pointed out, they were drawing maps and they were paying attention to communities of interest, Voting Rights Act, population equality, but they very publicly and intentionally did not consider partisanship as they drew their first set of maps. And so, as I think that what they saw at the end, and what I thought many people saw coming, was that they inadvertently drew Republican gerrymanders, which they've had to backpedal on, as Jeff pointed out. Was that the intention when this thing was written, that you could not take partisanship into account as you drew, so you'd end up in the corner they found themselves in?
It was designed more to be backloaded on the evaluation for the partisan fairness, for the specific reason that from the beginning of time, the maps that were being drawn by the legislature and the political parties focused on the partisanship, and also focused on protecting incumbents. I remember when I was working for the legislature one cycle, and the first question the speaker would ask is, well, what does John Dingell want? And then we took it from there.
We asked that too when we drew it, because we were afraid of John Dingell.
But it's, you look at the incumbents, and if you look at the maps, especially for the legislature, there are a boatload of legislators who, if they want to stay in office, are going to have to move, and they're going to be fighting other incumbents. And there's a lot of empty districts as a result because of that. But the partisan fairness is something that was factored into the amendment towards the back end, because we recognized from the beginning, Michigan, because of its weird geography, the distribution of people, is pretty difficult to draw fair maps, because the concentration of Democrats is so tight in the larger cities and in Southeast Michigan, whereas Republicans represent an awful lot of farmland and empty land. And it can be done. You've both seen it done. You both could do it, but it is a very difficult process. So they were kind of feeling their way, and they were very slow in bringing in consultants on drawing the maps, and they got off to a very slow start. Mark and I have talked about this before. They kind of were dawdling for quite a while when they could have been getting a lot more work done while they were waiting for the census. They could have been drawing some maps based on the best guess of what the census was going to show. They could have started there. They also could have started their hearings a little bit earlier, although that was complicated by COVID. So they ran into a lot of obstacles. And again, you've got a commission of 13 people who have never done anything like this in their lives. Very few of them even have any management experience. None of them had any public policy experience to speak of. So it was a huge challenge for them. And you know, in a way, we kind of did them dirty, because we gave them a really tough job to do, and they came into it cold.
I think, yeah, you just outlined one of the significant problems there, is that they're playing in the Super Bowl of Michigan politics. There are 13 people who've never played football before, and they showed up without practicing and waited until the game started to learn how to play. And that is kind of an observation that I made. They dawdled through the entire year. They did some of the required steps of listening to public comment and input, which was fine, but that didn't preclude them from also learning the nuts and bolts, learning the demographics of the state, the geography of the state, learning the culture of the state. And they just never seemed to do that. And they went more on anecdotal information than actual fact when it came down to it. And then they painted themselves into these corners on things like communities of interest, like Voting Rights Act and majority minority districts, and partisan fairness. They just didn't do their homework, and they weren't ready to play the game.
I think you're right, Jeff, but I also think, you know, there were things they could have done You know, in full disclosure here, you know, I was one of the lawyers in the federal gerrymandering case, which you were a witness a couple of years ago.
I remember you from that. Now I was on the witness stand. Yeah, you're familiar, but right?
My point is, when the judges wrote their opinion, it's very detailed. They pointed out that you, Jeff, smart map drawer that you were drawing practice maps even before the census, a year before the census data was available, based on, and that's like you just said, you could have practiced. Or if you read that opinion, you didn't have to even read that closely. You could see that not splitting up urban areas in Michigan leads to a gerrymander. And instead, they discovered that at the end of their first set of maps when they could have done it from the beginning. Because right away, the first thing they fell into was using whole townships, using whole cities, because that's convenient. Well, again, if they had read that opinion, they'd have known that, yeah, that's convenient, but it's also going to lead you into a gerrymander. So there were things out there, like that opinion and other methods, things they could have done to give themselves the kind of education in advance that you've been talking about.
Well, and Walt, I mean, one of the things that they did hire some really good experts with a lot of experience, Kim Brace, John Morgan, people who I've worked very closely with John Morgan over the years, and I've attended a lot of conferences and was part of a task force through the National Conference of State Legislatures, part of a task force with Kim Brace. These people are the most accomplished professionals in the redistricting business across the country, and the commission didn't have them do anything other than click a mouse. When you were crafting the proposal, envisioning how this was going to work, did you envision that the commissioners would avail themselves of that kind of professional experience? Or did you see it working out the way that they chose to implement it, which was to kind of disregard and kind of avoid using any professional experience?
The model we had in mind was comparable to jury trials, where the jury is seated from regular citizens, but the jury doesn't do any of the fact finding. The jury is presented the facts by partisans on both sides, a few advocates on both sides, and then the jury makes a judgment as to whose version to accept. That's not the way they went at it. They kind of wanted to do the maps hands on themselves. And I think that was probably a fundamental mistake. The other thing that they could have done, too, is we've got a lot of expertise in this state in our universities that they didn't fully take advantage of. They used a little bit of it early on for their redistricting 101 classes in the beginning, but then they kind of ignored Michigan State and University of Michigan and Wayne State University, all of which have really excellent faculty who are experts in this area, and they could have taken greater advantage of that. When I first started working on redistricting a million years ago, one of the thoughts I had for a commission was a 9-member commission composed of 3 experts each from the 3 constitutional universities, Wayne, Michigan State, and Michigan, and let them draw the maps. That, of course, would have kind of pissed off the Republicans because most of those professors would be assumed to be liberal. But at least you would have had experts there who would have been able to really meet any constitutional requirement that we drew into the proposal. This is a little bit tougher because they ignored some of the expertise and then they tried to take some of it on themselves. Again, using your analogy about the Super Bowl, they were calling the plays instead of letting the head coach call the plays, and they were just executing it.
It seems to me another way they could have gone, Walt, is the way Colorado Commission has done. And they basically said to their staff, draw some draft maps for us and bring them back, yeah. Right? They could have tasked Morgan and Brace and Adelson and Hanley with generating a lot of maps. And I got to tell you, I agree with Jeff. Morgan and Brace have drawn thousands of maps probably by this point in their career and could have produced draft maps very quickly. And that really would have moved things along rather than the commission working as a committee of the whole, which is really hard. 13 people plus their lawyers and experts in the room, never having done it before. That would have been a different way to go about it and might have produced a better product.
You know, I remember when early on when we were working on the proposal, a professor from the University of Michigan created, I think, like 1,000 maps for us. And he did it in a couple of days. And he was able to build in the criteria that we thought were important. And he generated a bunch of maps, all of which were pretty good. They ranged from decent to really good. And that's the kind of thing that could be done with the commission just acting as a jury rather than as the lawyers.
Yeah, it seems to me there are a fair number of objective factors in what you wrote. Population, is objectively determined. You know, when you get to things like VRA, there's a lot of objective pieces to that. Contiguity, obviously, compactness, there are measures, even partisan measures,
just,
as you wrote. Yeah. And so you could, I think, generate computer models, but then there would still have to be some human judgment because communities of interest aren't reducible to a mathematical formula. But again, that's where your jury comes in and says, well, you did all these things objectively, but we've got to temper it. We've got to adjust it because of these subjective factors.
Yeah. Do we want to split apart Kent County or do we want to split East Lansing from Lansing for our legislative or state Senate district? Those types of things are things a computer can't figure out.
Right.
Now, we've spent a good deal of time here talking about, you know, kind of critiquing some of the things that have happened. Are you game for putting, you know, looking into the crystal ball and kind of, you know, where do you see this going now? Here we're nearing the end. They've got these 15 maps out there, several collective maps, some individual commissioner submitted maps. Would you care to harbor a guess? How are they going to choose from among the finished products that they have out there? Are they going to tweak this? What do you see happening as the commission moves to their kind of their final phase here before what I'm sure we all anticipate some levels or different legislation or litigation as we move into 2022?
Seems like there's a lot of controversy over the state house maps more than any of them, which I can understand because the districts are so small. It's really very hard to meet all of the criteria and do it fairly and also to maintain voting rights districts, et cetera. So I think that there's a good possibility that they'll tweak what they've got now pretty substantially for those maps. From what I've read, and I'm not an expert like you guys when it comes to how the maps play out, but it looks like the congressional maps, not too bad. The state Senate maps, not too bad, but the state House map, from everything I've heard, is kind of a real disaster, the options they have so far. But it's going to end up in court. It's going to be another field day for the lawyers. I know that makes Mark happy, even though you haven't got a horse in this race.
It actually doesn't make me happy. I wish we could. But I mean, let me push that a little bit, Walt, because what you all put in Prop 2 in terms of litigation in the Supreme Court is very, very similar to what was in the Constitution before. You took out the time limit and a couple of other procedural pieces, but it's basically the same. So what do you envision the Supreme Court doing? What's your mission? What's your purpose there?
I think the Supreme Court's going to give a lot of deference to the commission just based on the ruling that put us on the ballot in the first place. The only change we've had on the Supreme Court since then is a couple of seats have flipped from Republicans to Democrats. And I think it was the Democrats plus a couple of so-called turncoat Republicans that put us on the ballot in the first place. So I can see the court giving as much deference as possible to the commission. Plus the way that the amendment, the language was written, if there is disagreement and the courts find a constitutional flaw in the maps, they have to remand it back to the commission. The commission, by state constitution, is the only organization that can draw maps, not the state Supreme Court or a special master. What the federal courts do is another issue. They, you know, they're totally unpredictable.
Right. And this is where I would ask Mark, is the, you know, the seasoned attorney in on redistricting that he is, if I was still, you know, running Republican operations, advising the Republican Party, the way I'd be looking at this is to try to get this into federal court, where I do know that they give great deference to state courts and state legislatures. But what I'd hang my hat on is I'd try to split the same way they did back with term limits. I would say, look, the U.S. Constitution says that legislatures draw congressional districts. And I'd be trying to sever that. You do what you want in Michigan with your legislature, but you've completely bollocked up the way the Constitution says to draw congressional districts. And, you know, we'll appoint a federal panel or a special master here to do that. What do you think the likelihood of something like that is, you know, given the, I guess, the political calculus and the likely legal outcomes?
Right. I think that'll be tried either here in Michigan or elsewhere, Jeff. There was a decision regarding the Arizona Commission a few years ago by the U.S. Supreme Court, which rejected what you just described, that said, no, legislature in this context means wherever the legislative power is. And in Arizona, they gave it to the commission. That's fine. However, the Supreme Court of the United States has changed dramatically since then. Two of the justices in the 5-4 majority are gone, Kennedy and Ginsburg, replaced by two new people, and Chief Justice Roberts was a dissenter in that case. So I believe Republicans, either through Michigan or other states, are going to challenge these commissions again, their authority to do congressional redistricting. I don't think that if they succeed, the Republicans in that, I don't think the court will draw the map. I think the court will say, legislature, you get to draw these maps.
Right? I think there's one thing, Mark, that could save the commission, even in a federal court that is tilted in that direction. And that's Article 1, Section 1 of our state constitution, which says all political power is inherent in the people. And by inference, that means the ultimate legislature in Michigan is the people.
No, I agree. Well, there are counter arguments, right? That our constitution also says the people can decide where to put this power. And when they adopted Prop 2, they put it in the commission. And that should be respected in that regard. So I think there are actually what I would argue are some federalist type arguments against Republicans trying to take the congressional redistricting away from the commission. But ultimately, the U.S. Supreme Court, yeah, I think, is going to decide this one way or the other.
Well, and I was just going to chime in that we've seen such consistency, and certainly I couldn't imagine any Republican lawyers who are members of the Federal Society would dare act like hypocrites on such a thing. I say that with tongue in cheek because they've abandoned pretty much most of those principles they've espoused over the years. So it's fascinating, and I guess maybe the short answer to my question is where is this going to go? Is it's going to remain political. There's going to be a whole lot of ups and downs. It's going to be heard in different courtrooms. And I still think that there's a very good chance that we end up with a delayed filing deadline in 2022 based on these decisions coming late, either consensus coming out of the commission, litigation, judges won't necessarily work on our filing deadline schedule. It's not unprecedented in states to have primary election dates moved if the circumstances warrant doing so. So 2022 could be a heck of a lot of chaos, more so than most election years.
I think that's right, Jeff. Historically, Michigan's never had the primary moved in August. We have had filing deadlines adjusted, and we've had redistricting plans adopted as late as June. And still, successfully held primary elections. I know that's an election administrator's nightmare, but it can be done. It can be done. Hopefully it doesn't come to that, but you know, we've gone through this before, several election cycles in Michigan in the one person, one vote era.
Sure. And when I say states have had their primaries moved, most states have earlier primaries earlier in the calendar than Michigan does. And having such a late primary in August, we're at the tail end of the state primaries across the country. So the odds of that happening here are less. And, you know, there really isn't any time on the calendar after the early August to then print ballots and have a successfully run November election. I mean, so
that would be chaos anyway.
Yeah, that would be very disruptive if that were to happen.
Yeah, you know, and again, you know, it's through no fault of the commission, the pandemic has really caused a problem here. Under the normal schedule, we'd be litigating now. The plans would have been adopted November 1, right? If they'd gotten the census data when they should have. And we'd be litigating now, and there'd be a lot less worry about filing deadlines and moving primaries because this would all get resolved. But boy, oh boy, this thing certainly got collapsed in terms of a time frame.
Yeah, I'd like to finish on a positive note, and that is the overall process and where it began with nine people who were absolutely nobody in Michigan politics. I'd been a failed candidate for the state house. That was my claim to fame. And nobody else had been involved in politics at all. And somehow we came up with 450,000 signatures, got 61% of the vote, and a process that, while flawed, is still one hell of a lot better than what we had. And I think I would give the commission right now, even with all the screw ups, I'd still give them a B+ on what they've accomplished so far, given that there was really no precedent for them and they had to make up the rules right from the get go.
We normally say this at the end of the broadcast, but I'll say if the Republic is still standing in 10 years, maybe they'll get a chance to do that again. I'm not holding my breath right now. There's a lot that has to happen in 2022 and 2024 before we know if we'll still have a republic then.
Yeah.
But, you know, my hat's off to you. I was certainly from a, you know, somebody who put their thumb on the scale when it came to the maps over, you know, the last 20 years, definitely looked at this from a different perspective, complete diametrical opposite perspective. I was still a skeptic of the process in the amendment in 2018. I've now become a believer in reform. I commend you and the team at Voters Not Politicians, all of you nine who got it started, all of the hundreds or thousands of volunteers that got it onto the ballot. They were successful because they didn't realize it was impossible to do what they did. And they defied what everybody expected to happen. And it is a better, it's going to produce better results than the politicians who've been involved in the process over the last several decades have produced for the voters in Michigan. So
yeah, I would say one thing on that, Jeff, to disagree. You didn't put your thumb on the scales. You treated it like a teeter-totter. You were full body in.
I'll agree with Jeff. Kudos. And I say this publicly, kudos to VNP for what they did. We have seen an improved, more public process, but I'm going to give the commission an incomplete at this point because I want to see the maps. I think that's the ultimate test. Are they going to produce fair maps which comply with the criteria you set out, Walt?
Well, normally you'd say goodbye to the guest and hope he comes back again, but I guess I'll be back next week regardless.
Yeah, you're stuck with us.
And with that, we call this week's podcast to a close. Our great thanks to guest Walt Sorg, who's also, as we've noted throughout this episode, our producer. Thank you for sharing your experience and your insight and for joining the conversation.
My pleasure.
And if the Republic is still standing in a week, we'll be back. In the meantime, don't hesitate to give us comments at arepublicpodcast.com. And I want to join Jeff. And kudos to Walt for his amazing career, for the great job he does producing us every week. And so we look forward to a continued partnership, Walt, Jeff, and I.
Thank you. It's been great fun. Been great fun for the last few months.
I'm Jeff Timmer.
And I'm Mark Brewer. We'll see you next week if the Republic is still standing.
You can subscribe to A Republic if you can keep it on your favorite podcast app. A Republic, if you can keep it, is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.